Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show, where we celebrate top performers producing better results in less time. I'm Stone Payton, joined with my co-host, Lee Cantor. How you going? How you doing, Lee?
I am doing awesome, Stone. What about you? How was your weekend?
It was really good. I've spent most of it packing. I'm headed to London this week.
So you started packing? That doesn't sound like a guy.
Well, it didn't take terribly long, but, you know, you got to get the right clothes. I had to buy a new pair of tennis shoes. But I'll be in London next week, and we're going to have a guest host.
Oh.
And his name is Don Rigby. He's joined us in the studio today. We're not putting him on the mic. We're not putting him live today, but he's gonna watch the show today and get a feel for it, and he will be your guest host next week.
That'll be good.
Who's our sponsor today?
Today, our show is sponsored by J.M. Walker Group and Integrity Solutions. Remember, build your people, and they will build your business. And the website is jmwalkergroup.com, 770-578-1345.
You know, Lee, I am actually in the process of going through one of these Integrity Solutions sales training classes. Mark Walker's conducting it, and I do have a little bit of a warning or caveat for the listening audience. If you're a sales manager, a sales VP, and thinking about putting your people through a sales training, if what you're after is some sort of passive educational experience for your team, run, do not walk from this outfit as fast as you can. They really do hold your feet to the fire. It's a highly interactive process. And it truly is about behavior change, not just about education or knowledge. So for what it's worth, Integrity Solutions and the J.M. Walker Group certainly have the full endorsement of the High Velocity Radio Show.
Good stuff.
We've got a great show for you this morning. First, we're going to talk to a branding expert. And then after that, a gentleman is going to join us who is the CEO of a marketing automation firm. We're going to talk about scoring, nurturing, tracking, and whatever else it is you're supposed to do with leads. But first up is Steve Winokur with Turning Point Strategies, which is a branding and repositioning firm. Steve Winokur is regularly cited in leading business journals, including the Wall Street Journal. He's featured in the next issue of Strategy Magazine, which I am really looking forward to asking him a little bit more about. And I understand he has a new book coming out this spring with a brilliant co-author. So maybe we'll get a chance to talk about that as well. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Hey, good morning, Stone.
Hey, tell us about Strategy Magazine.
Well, I had the publisher just started this magazine. This second issue is due to hit the stands October 26th. I had met him over the summer, and we talked about the magazine and the reasons, you know, why he started it. And he had. We started talking about the Growth Gap, which is a service that we offer here at Turning Point, and he was intrigued by it. And his magazine is really structured to deliver actionable content to the readers. So it's not a magazine of just kind of academic research where someone can, well, that sounds interesting, but I can't do anything with it. It really is designed to provide information to people that they can read it and then take it back to their business. So he thought the Growth Gap was a topic that his readers would enjoy reading about, and so we interviewed me and we talked about the Growth Gap. And
so, what's the Growth Gap? Or do we have to wait for the magazine to come out?
You have to buy the magazine.
You have to buy the magazine,
right?
Or you know, send a you know, was it $3.99 directly to me? And I'll get you one. The Growth Gap is. Let me back up for a second. I would imagine most of your listeners, as well as most businesses out there, one of their primary goals is they want to grow their business. Well, what I've learned is that you can't wake up one day and decide, okay, I'm going to grow my business today and just grow your business. To do that, you need to affect one of the levers, one of the five levers of the revenue formula. So that's kind of how the Growth Gap was formed, was let's look at the different places, that different ways you can grow revenue. You know, it's number of prospects, your conversion rate, your loyalty, how long you keep customers, your expansion gap, how many products and services you sell them, and then the margin, which is basically the price that you're able to charge for your product or services. So it allows us and allows the business to look at their revenue formula in a more detailed way to see, okay, where are the areas that we can grow to then grow our business.
So is one lever, in your experience, more important than another?
Not the levers, per se, but a lot of the tactics that you do to close one of them really work in multiple, or can work to close multiple gaps. So when you look at each of them, you're looking at where you might have problems, and I don't necessarily think any particular one is more important in a kind of general sense. I think depending on the economy and other things that are happening, sometimes you might want to direct more attention towards one. For example, the first gap, the prospect gap, is really about attracting more qualified prospects. Well, a lot of that's lead generation. Well, lead generation can be one of the most expensive gaps.
You tell me, right?
Whereas the other, you know, looking at the customer gap, which is really about loyalty and repeat purchases, that one doesn't, you don't have to necessarily spend a lot of money to work at closing. So when we go through the growth gap, we do our growth gap analysis, we're going to pick out the things that the problem areas and then prioritize them. So long-term wise, maybe you do have a lead generation problem, but in the short term, there are some things we might want to do to shore up your loyalty and to shore up some repeat purchases and some things that are relatively inexpensive to fix to help you start growing your business before we start tackling some of the more expensive problems.
Now, Stone introduced you as a branding expert. How does branding fit into all this?
Well, branding really is a collection of perceptions in the mind of your employees, your customers, your prospects, just the general marketplace. And what my firm really focuses on is helping companies articulate what makes them different in the marketplace, which is really the core behind your brand. It's the promise you're making. This is what we're different. This is how we're different than our competitors. So an experience with us is different than an experience with somebody else because of these reasons. A lot of people think brand is all about your logo and the colors of your logo and your mascot and your jingle and your tagline. And those things really work to get the message out to your target market, but that's not your brand.
And so, well, I mean, that really does bring up a good question because at least my perspective has often been that maybe branding is fine for the, you know, Coke or Nike or Callaway Golf. Is this a conversation that really does have any immediate merit for the mid-sized small business?
You know, I run into that conversation quite often with CEOs and business owners of small to medium-sized businesses because they think, yeah, you know, Coke needs a brand, Nike needs a brand. You know, I don't. I'm too small to have a brand. And what I explain to them is every business has a brand. So you can either not accept that fact and not try to do anything to influence it, but you do have one. So to me, it makes a lot of sense to try to control those perceptions and influence those perceptions. And my argument to them is, you know, Coke and Nike, they spend millions and millions of dollars on advertising,
mm-hmm.
print, radio, television. Small businesses don't have that kind of resources. So to me, focusing on building your brand is more important to a small business than it is large business because – you know, Coke will pull up a billboard on, you know, downtown Atlanta, and, you know, a certain percentage of the people that drive by it will be influenced by
it. Yeah, it makes you thirsty.
Right, exactly. You know, obey your thirst, and I want a Sprite now. But small businesses can't afford a billboard downtown. They need to really focus their message on a target market. And the way to do that is really articulating what makes you different. So if you're just out there, you know, shooting wildly, it gets very expensive. So to me, the small business is better served by really focusing on their brand so that their target market knows who they are and why they should buy from them.
Are small businesses better served to be more niche-y?
I believe so.
I like that, niche-y.
Niche-y.
Or niche-y.
How's that for a
niche-y.
Tagline?
Niche-y. Yeah. Niche-y. For the highbrow listeners.
I firmly believe to look at the overall target market and find a niche that you can serve better than anybody else.
So it's better to be kind of the big fish in the small pond?
Yes. A place on our website where I talk about, you know, think outside the fishbowl, and it's this whole concept of playing in a space where you don't have a lot of competitors.
Even if that means creating that space.
Right. And often it does mean creating that space because – You know, if it's if the space is there, there's often have competitors there. So the idea is look at your whole target market, and then you know there's some areas that, that you do really better than anybody else, and focus on marketing into that particular target market.
Mm-hmm.
A great example I always use, and people who know me are probably sick of hearing this, but if you're driving down the road in a Ford truck and you need something happens, you're like, I need to pull into a mechanic. And you see on one side of the street, you see a mechanic that says, we serve all makes and models. And then across the street, you see one, we work on Ford trucks. Mm. Which one are you going to pull into? You're going to pull into the one that works on Ford trucks. And you know what? You're going to pay a price premium.
Right.
But they're the experts in fixing Ford trucks.
So being a specialist is better than being a generalist?
I believe so. I think that's really where you're able to affect the margin gap, really be able to charge a premium because you're perceived as the expert for that particular target market. I'd say I always like to say is, you know, if you're you know, if you're trying to be everything to everyone,
you end up being nothing to no one.
Well, you end up being nothing to no one.
Right.
You know, I mean, you end up trying to, you know, you're all over the place and nobody knows, well, why should I call this particular company? Whereas, like I said, if you work on Ford trucks, you know, hey, you're going to get a large percentage of the Ford truck owners.
So how do you help your client get that kind of mind share where you become the guy, you know?
Well, a lot of it is, all right, you know, doing that analysis, then figuring out, okay, what do we need to do inside our company to re-engineer our operations, what we do, our procedures, to back up that promise? So in the case of the, you know, the Ford truck example, you know, if you have mechanics that are know the insides and out of a Honda, doesn't really help you. So you would want to send them to, you know, Ford
truck training.
Exactly. you know, and look at all your operations from the point of a customer. I'm really a big proponent of whatever your brand promise is. So in this case, it would be, you know, working that we're the Ford truck company.
Right.
So everything that you do needs to back up that brand promise. So whatever, you know, internally the waiting room, the way your bay is set up for trucks pulling in, everything throughout the whole organization
is Ford truck friendly.
Right. Exactly. The last F3. Thing you
want.
Yeah. you know, and it's just that's the, you know, and taking that to other businesses is really looking at, like I said, everything you're doing, does it back up and further your brand promise or does it take away from it? And that even – we have a product we call the brand blueprint, which really is designed to get that brand promise in a document on the wall of the executive's office.
Hmm.
And that's – the goal there is really that brand promise needs to serve as a filter for all the business decisions that business owner or the CEO makes. If you're whatever your brand promise is, if it comes down to, you know, phone systems, janitorial, whatever, every decision within a business, that the business owner needs to look at that brand promise and say, okay, is this decision going to further what I'm promising to my customers, or is it going to take away from it? Now you might still decide that, yeah, it takes away from it, but we're going to do it anyway. But as long as you're cognizant of that fact, that's the key. So I was using an example with Stone in an earlier conversation that if you're all about personalized service, you know, you pick up the phone, you get to talk to a person within, you know, one ring, and somebody comes and wants to sell you a phone system that's going to save you $1,000 a month, but you got to go through an automated attendant. Well, yeah, it's great to save $1,000 a month, but you're not backing up your promise anymore.
Right. It's not congruent anymore.
Exactly. Congruent's a perfect word, Lee.
What are some other mistakes that you see out there?
One of the things about the growth gaps is each of the problems that people have to actually kind of close them is each one of them has a misconception that kind of causes the gap to happen in the first place. So a big problem I typically see is if somebody comes to us and says, you know, we need help with lead generation. The common kind of first reaction is, okay, let's widen our net.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you know, we need more sales, we need more prospects, so let's target everybody. And in reality, the exact opposite is true. It gets back to what Lee we were talking about before with if narrowing and focusing your market. That's if you really want more qualified prospects, the way to accomplish that goal is to narrow your target market and narrow your net instead of widening it. So that's one of those, a big mistake that I see.
And that's counterintuitive.
Exactly. You know, and most of those, you know, most or all the gaps have that counterintuitive feel to it. You were like, well, that doesn't, you know, always make a lot of sense. But when you stop and think about it and analyze it, that does make sense, and it's true. And I think that's kind of the
and
problem.
And it's easier and more affordable to market to a narrower niche.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I've got the itch to niche. How about you, Lee? Yeah. So what else is coming up? What, do you have any upcoming events? Or?
I'm a member of Growth Answers, which is a sales and marketing consortium here in Atlanta. And we have an event in November, November 18th, I believe. It's a Tuesday at the Georgian Club. You can go to growthanswers.com and go to the live learning events. And we have a great topic on viral marketing and the use of video online. Brent Brooks is going to be speaking. Great. So it should be a great, fun event for everybody.
And how can our listeners get in contact with you?
To contact with me, just go to www.tp, as in turning point, strategies.com.
TPStrategies.com, pick up Strategy Magazine. And so do they have to know some underground publisher to get
nope.
this? Or we're going to get it.
You can get it at Borders and Barnes & Noble, I know for sure, and I imagine it's probably at most major newsstands. I'd also like to direct the listeners. You can go to my website, go to that TPStrategies.com, and then put /growth gap, all mm-hmm. one word. And there is a self-assessment, the 30-question self-assessment that
your
readers can go through that will help them start to look at their business in a new light, and it should help uncover some issues that they maybe haven't thought of that will help them look to grow their business.
Oh, that sounds great. Say that URL one more time.
It's tpstrategies.com
mm-hmm.
/growth gap.
Oh, terrific.
And I've offered, if anybody downloads that and once they fill it out, want to talk to me about it, I'm offering a free 30-minute consultation based on just to talk through the results of that self-assessment and help them get them pointed in the right direction.
Well, great. Well, thanks so much for joining us on the show. Before we let you go, and you know this is coming because I gave you a little advance warning.
I do.
Here on the High Velocity Radio Show, we ask each guest, if they would, to please share a mistake they've made somewhere in their career. And really, more importantly, what they've learned from it. Would you be willing to do that for
Certainly,
us?
Stone. Our conversation here leads perfectly into this because several years ago, when I had my company did a lot of different things. In addition to the brand and strategy work, we did a lot of what I would call marketing communications work. So we did websites and brochures and mm-hmm. The traditional marketing tactics. Well, this was before the name of the company was Turning Point Strategies, and we didn't follow our own philosophy of focusing. So we were, we had the staff, we could do it. So we did all these marketing communications projects while also trying to do strategic branding projects. And there were two distinct target markets with two distinct messages. And we were trying to do this at the same time because, we thought we could. And what we found over time was that the marketplace was confused. Nobody knew who we were. And our attention was pulled in all different directions. So while we were kind of thinking we could grow both sides of the business, what we found is neither side was growing because we were, our attention was all over the place. The marketplace didn't understand who we were. So what I really learned is what I teach my clients is about focusing on a target market. What I learned is, to listen to myself and treat myself as a client. So we decided to rebrand ourselves as Turning Point Strategies. We dropped the marketing communications work. So the message is really, I think, learning to focus. Pick something or a series of services that you're really good at. Find a target market that needs that product or service. Build a message specific to that target market and then go after them like crazy.
And so now you're out there pitching the niche.
Right, exactly. real estate's all about location, location, location. Mm-hmm. I believe growing your business and sales and marketing brain is all about focus, focus, focus.
Oh, so well said. Thanks so much for joining
us. Thanks,
Stone. Can you hang out with us while we visit with our next guest?
Most certainly, Stone.
Terrific. Well, next up is a gentleman by the name of Richard Brock. And he literally pioneered the Salesforce automation industry in 1984 when he founded Brock Control Systems. Sales and Marketing Automation magazine named this gentleman one of the 10 most influential people in CRM, which I believe stands for Customer Relationship Management, but we'll get that clarified. Today, he is CEO of LeadLife, a marketing automation firm Welcome to the show, Richard Brock.
Well, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So why automate? Why even go to the trouble of scoring leads?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm reminded of an old cartoon that came out 15 years ago, and it had a picture of two dogs when the internet first came out. One dog's looking at the other one and says, on the internet, no one knows you're a dog. And I remember that, and we're now starting to use that in our own marketing, because 15 years ago it was funny for one reason, and it's tragically funny today. And so the problem, marketing automation is an umbrella for not only about marketing automation per se, but what is marketing automation? I mean, sales automation is a vending machine. You put in 50 cents to get a Coca-Cola. Marketing automation, you know, that's so not a lot of people can automate their sales. Certainly you can't automate your marketing, but you automate the communications that you have with your prospects. Probably the most fundamental shift that's happened is the way people are buying products. Today, 80% of the B2B products begin with an internet search. And most companies are doing a lousy job of basically capturing that data. We're not recognizing the change in the buyer behavior. So that is what the current venue of marketing automation companies is all about, is capturing the digital behavior and using it to change the buying cycle.
Well, you know, when I hear the word automate, sometimes I cringe and I wonder if marketing executives and sales executives inside organizations cringe. The thought that comes to me almost instinctively is, well, yeah, but our business is different. You know, I'm not sure automation is really going to fit for what we're doing.
Well, I think that they have to look at what has changed. And it used to be, for example, in the automation, CRM applications used to take a salesperson and he'd get a phone call from a prospect saying, please send me information about your company. And so they would send the literature. And then they would follow up the phone call. And they had the person's accurate address because that's how the person got the brochure. Mm. Well, with the internet, it's all changed. And so now people are moving towards digital marketing and away from the trade magazines and all of the above. So you have to economically, here's the difference. I used to be able to talk to someone on the phone and say, well, you're not qualified, so I'll send you the smaller brochure. The nicer brochure, or I'll never call you back. At this point, we don't know that they're a dog or not. So how do you determine if they're a dog? So if they're not going to call you, and they are not. So the sales cycle or the buying cycle is going to begin long before the sales cycle now. So if you're going to be involved in the sales cycle, you've got to use the potential or prospects, fingerprints, digital fingerprints, to determine what literature to send them, because they're going to download the white papers and the case studies that are relevant to them. But you've got to translate this new way of buying into actions for the sales reps. So the automation is about, and they, believe it or not, this may interest you, but just because they go to your website, they're going to your website, they're gathering information earlier than they used to in a buying cycle. So they're not ready to talk to a sales rep. So if you wait for them to call a sales rep or be ready to talk, you're going to miss most of them. So the first part is, or if you call them, you're going to freak them out, okay? You've got to nurture the relationship. You have to fulfill their interest. Let's just say, for example, they're asking about tennis rackets, sending information about tennis rackets, not sending golf club information, and certainly for the golf club things. So maybe taking that more in the marketing automation space, if we're responding to a president of a company, the president's interested in marketing return on investment. What percentages, case studies can you show about increasing sales with doing this? Now, we also market to the senior marketing executives, and they know that this will work, so their interest is about the mechanics of how you properly lead, score lead, so that you don't overwhelm the salesman with a bunch of unqualified leads. Because that problem has been around forever, and it's finally going to be addressed, not because people should, but because they had to. And I would, by way of analogy of today's time, to give you the emphasis here, I would say that the gas price has recently parked a heck of a lot of Hummers, okay, for the price of gas.
Yeah.
And similarly, I'd say that this economy is going to park a whole bunch of the old methods of lead maintenance and lead generation and lead management. It just doesn't work anymore in today's economy. It didn't work before. You know, it wasn't smart not to use internet-based marketing, and now it's mandatory with the cost of sales and the fewer buyers, the fewer dollars being spent.
So when you're doing this automation, what are the elements? You had mentioned you're kind of vetting each person that comes to the website, right? And you're doing it in a manner of giving them the material that they're asking for when they ask for it. So what are, like you mentioned, case studies and white papers, what's kind of the menu that you have to be able to offer?
Well, I think the real menu has to be relevance, and you have to recognize different people buy for different motives. So you very quickly in your website with personal landing pages and things like that, so when they come from an ad, and one thing we do that's interesting is we integrate with the printing world. We've got a lot of good printers that are partners, and they're recognizing this is the way for them to validate the value of what they're doing. So when someone comes to a website from an ad that's advertising, let's say golf clubs, for example, you better show them a web page that's about golf clubs. And if they come back to that website, you better reflect their previous behavior and show the clubs. And then the buying, the nurturing cycle is like you then, with print, you follow up with a postcard with a picture of the golf clubs that they were comparing one to the other and say, look, if you can make a purchase this quarter, I'll give you 10% off or 20% if you buy them both or whatever the case may be. So it's relevant, it's multimedia, it's timely, it's emails following up on the website traffic.
So your company helps the client through this, because that sounds pretty complicated. There's a lot of moving parts to that.
It's really quite easy because if you have the enabling technology, and you have to, and there are several vendors out there that have it, it'd be impossible to do the old-fashioned way. But if you're capturing the digital behavior because you know what web pages are going to, then the business rules, which are really easy to set up, can send the autoresponder to set a series of subsequent follow-ups, whether they be turn it over to the sales executive right away because they are really ready to talk. Not usually, but it's important. Or send them some more literature about the area which they're interested in. Finally, the sales reps will get an opportunity to talk to them when they raise their hand and say, I'd like to talk to a sales rep. So it's not as hard as you think, and it's really quite simple to implement. It wasn't simple to develop, but it's simple for the customer to implement. It's a matter of clipping their web pages and saying, if they went here and spent this much time, I'd give them this many points or that many points in this page, et cetera, et cetera. And so the fulfillments and everything is driven from what the customer is self-selecting, and that's the key. Mm-hmm.
And then how did you get that? How did you score the data? Like how did you know what looking at this page is worth 3 points and looking at that page is worth 1 point?
Well, Lee, that's a good question. And my personal goal is to create a huge disparity of scoring. So you don't want to do 1.3 points. You want to like 15 points or 50 points or 100 points so that the behavior really stands out as a particular uniqueness. Now, one of our clients is a good case in point. It's Bearing Point. We have 8 divisions of Bearing Point. There's a webinar on our website for an hour where he talks about how he got a 78% improvement in qualified leads, 10% total decrease in cost of sales using this marketing automation. Yeah. Now, what they do in one division, and each division is different, but this particular one, the one that's on the webinar, what they are very focused upon, because they have expensive sales resources, these consultants, so they don't want to put them on people who are not ready to buy.
Right.
So you and I might think, well, if you download this white paper in this particular risk area, he'd be very interested. Or if he went to this webinar, he'd be very interested. And yes, he'll get both of those scores. But where they really kick in is they say, if you went to the webinar and you download the white paper, then you start to raise up. And so he's very tight on his he's like logically sitting down. It's so easy to do with a series of rules to embody that. And he's even incorporated something that's interesting, that if I send you several fulfillment pieces and you still don't take the call or you don't respond or you don't come back to the website, he'll decrease the score because you're apparently not interested.
Right.
And he'll put you in a different autoresponder.
So when is a lead sales ready?
I think that's the most interesting part is it's really – there's a recent study, which, again, you can go to our website and download. It's by Chief Sales Officer Insights. And they are probably the experts on what keeps chief selling officers up at night. And it's still tragic that over 60% of the leads are still being generated by the sales organization, even though marketing's getting most of the money. And the problem is the salespeople don't have a confidence in the marketing person's leads. So the first thing you have to do is get a common definition, but you've got to break the barrier of communication between sales and marketing. And it's simply done, quite simply. Sales has to realize this is being done for them and not to them. And you do that by getting them involved in the scoring. They say, yeah, that makes sense to me. And then what you do is you say, look, we're going to take these website leads. You can see them because it's an automated system that feeds whatever CRM they're using. But it's better for both of us if you let marketing nurture it with this continuous following series of directly relevant pieces. And the sales rep goes, well, maybe. But you have to give them the ability to turn off individual accounts as normal. Handle this with myself, which is fine. And then what you also have to do is allow them to add the ones that they're working in there, and so this becomes a service to them. And then they see, you know what, it is better off for me to let marketing professionally, timely, in automation as well, because automation sends out the fulfillments when they should be sent out, and it's not concerned about the sales rep was out of town for a week making sales calls, closing for the quarter. So automation is a benefit to everybody, and it's been clearly shown, probably on some of our website things, clearly shown if you will overrun a sales force, you will get fewer sales out of a given marketing dollar unfortunately, are hundreds of thousands of dollars of marketing spend. You'll get fewer revenue dollars if you turn all the leads over to sales if you nurture them. And that's a funny statistic. But it's because they cherry pick them. They don't nurture enough of them. And we got these discreet buyers that they're not going to buy today. But the statistic that's often quoted, and it's, I've seen it to be true, that 70% of the people who inquire about a product like you're offering will ultimately buy it, probably within 2 years. Only 30% are going to buy one within a year. But the problem with most companies, if you're not in that 30% that's going to buy now, you're gone. And they go to a competitor down the road. So the trick of marketing automation this tough time is to keep that 40% that are being ignored by the sales force, and rightly so, because they do have to pay their bills and the company's bills. That 40% needs to be nurtured, because they're not going to come back to you again, another thing. But you got to constantly reinforce and send them things about which they're interested, and then they'll come back to the surface. And that's the trick, is converting these dollars to more.
And those 40% will be nurtured through this automated system, right? So
correct.
It's not any manpower that's really doing this.
Well, you know, that's the thing. If you're going to do it right, you have to look at manpower. And so, based upon the lead quality, when you initially score a lead, it's somebody who ought to be on a list to get subsequent emails, because they're inexpensive, virtually free. They don't look like a qualified buyer. You send them a newsletter so often. And then you go up the food chain, if you will. You might even elevate them to having telemarketing, outside telemarketing, because telemarketers are a lot less expensive per hour than a sales rep, and they're more consistent. So I'm not to say that. So I'm going to say telemarketing is a human touch. I'm going to say printing is something like, and believe it or not, postcards. You think, come on, postcards. Well, the thing about a postcard, it doesn't get thrown away without being seen. An envelope will. So people are using a mix of the phone calls, the emails, the postcards. The postcard with the picture of the golf club you were looking at will get your interest, which will then make you open the email, which you click on to buy the golf club you were looking at.
So it's all integrated.
It's all integrated, and it's not one. It's like we went to a restaurant. You know, I might say, what do you like? You know, you say, I like fish or I like chicken. Well, that's fine, but if we went out to dinner, I doubt that's all you'd order.
Right.
You know, and that's the trick, is it marketing is about a mix of solutions you bring to the plate.
And then this, I'm sure as you're doing this longer and longer, it's getting smarter and smarter, right?
It is getting smarter and smarter, and that's the real thing. In today's tight times, you know, too much dough joke, which is unfortunately a sad joke, is 50% of every marketing dollar is wasted. And without a marketing ROI, and that is really ridiculous. And this is
what the punchline is, and they don't know
which
50%.
They don't know which
50%.
But the CSO Insight study found that only 1 in 5 companies accurately knows the return on the marketing dollars. 1 in 5. Now, so what happens, budgets get tight and the presidents go, you'll have to cut back your marketing because, you know, we've got to cut back somewhere. But instead of, if you had a quantified way to say, look, boss, I cut these back because they were not working. But if I spend $10 here, I get back $40 in revenue. And the boss is all over that. So ever more so, the toughing economy is going to drive sophisticated marketing automation, because the ROIs are clear and obvious.
Right. And it's very it's accountable for itself. It's clear what works and what doesn't in this, right?
It's clear, and it's also because it's being done for the salesman, not to the salesman, if you will. If you nurture leads in more close, and you have the tracking, so the leads, if you give a bunch of leads from a trade show to a salesman, which has been proven many times to be a disaster, but if you put them in nurture, you know, then you know that what came out of this trade show, because they're in an automated system, an automated CRM system, and our system will look back into the major, CRM vendors, will look into the closed sales and pull those numbers back, so we get a cost per sale, which is very unique. I mean, that's what it's all about, right?
Right.
You don't want cost per lead, because that doesn't pay any bills. Cost per sale. And so you have to reach in the CRM system, and that means you have to get the leads in the CRM system, and it's far easier to get a sales rep to work a lead that's in a CRM system with an autoresponder than to key it in.
Is there ever been an instance where you put something in the system and you had something you thought was the proper nurturing system, and then you got the data back and you realized, oh, we can skip this whole step, or we should add another step? Does it give you that kind of information?
Oh, absolutely. That's the thing about the analytics, because like in our case, we have 8 million business-to-business email addresses, so we can increase volume for customers. And because we have the demographics of the number of employees and, you know, the titles we're sending to, the SIC codes or whatever, the secret of marketing is test, test, test. It's kind of funny, because one of the fun things we do in our office is we always bet on marketing campaigns, you know. I'll bet the other person will say, I bet a buck this one pulls better. And that's only the dollar denomination. It's just the buck. But it's fun. And we're shocked. We're shocked, because we'll write email copy. For a lot of our clients, we help them. And it shocks us which one pulls better. So the trick of marketing is not to let your opinion bias. I mean,
yeah.
You don't know. This is the buyer's money, and you're not the buyer. And I always say to our office that nobody in our office, the opinion that matters is not in this office, because we're not going to buy the stuff we sell.
Right. And that's another old advertising. It's not creative unless it sells.
That's exactly what it's about. And what we do is we show what sells, and we show why a bad idea is a bad idea. I mean, and once again, if you're not pushing the envelope with some ideas, you'll make huge marketing mistakes, as I'll share at the end of the session. My mistake is around marketing.
I was going to ask you what makes a good lead good and a bad lead bad, but it strikes me that maybe that is just so specific to the organization. Or are there some just basic things that really do make a good lead good and a bad one bad?
Well, I think if let's just say that we went to our prom, in high school prom, or the fifth grade cotillion where you first had a date with a girl. So you see all the people across the floor, and finally you go across there and you talk to somebody, whatever. So is that a good relationship or a bad relationship? So visually you like this person and you thought it would be interesting to talk to them. But you only know by talking to them. So it is the communications that are going back and forth. You know, when they're interested in things that you're interested in, and you're interested in what they're interested in, and you share common values or whatever the case may be. But that's true, because people buy from people, and people buy from people they like. So in today's world, when they're not going to talk to you until they're ready, you use their digital behavior. And so it's very, very easy to determine, you know, from what people are downloading, what they're really interested in. And then as you make a few sales, you determine a buyer does the following. And this is the beautiful part. In the past, you have to ask the sales rep, what do they do? Well, kind of, and it's from his memory or her memory from the last sale.
And that's subjective. This is more objective.
Well, and it's also the bad part about that, not only being subjective, it reflects what was done in that sales cycle, not what could have been done. So consistently, we go through and we show all the touch points and say, these touch points evidence a buyer, and the others do not. Now, I was telling you about decrementing the score based upon they're not responding to any more marketing messages we're sending. So they apparently are not worth the sales rep calling on. And law of large numbers. So the trick is you're going to spend, in today's economy, more than you used to get a lead. You're going to drop expensive things that don't pay off, like the magazines and the newsprint seems to be struggling. But even they are going to have the integration with the offline or the online marketing, rather. So you have the information. You got to capture it like you've never captured before, and you're not going to get it by forcing a sales rep to fill out a bunch of information. Even if they try, they'll get it wrong. And so you use the fingerprint on the website, the responses to the subsequent touches, and that is what a customer or a buyer will look like. And it's so clear, it slaps you upside the face, that these are buying characteristics, not what we thought they were going to be, but what they are. So we do more of that. We look for more people like this, and we know that these people respond to this type of message, and we just go where the low fruit is.
On the very front end, to get them to interact with you in the first place, is email marketing really practical, or has it just gotten to where it inundates people so much that they don't pay attention to it?
Well, I think the answer is yes and yes to both your questions. And so you have to be different. The first thing is you have to get delivered, which is, you know, we do a lot of email marketing for people. And it's very hard to get through the spam filters, and there's things you can say that'll get your message thrown in the junk file and get your company site blacklisted and all those horrible things that can happen from you. So you got to do it right so that you're able to reach the buyer. And once again, you've got a very short, you know, time span. You better offer value. And I think the real difference is in email marketing especially, you better have an offer that is appealing, something they want. And it better be delivered very quickly. And what we do is we use an email like the CSO Insight survey. People who are interested in marketing want to know more about that. And there's no obligation. You can't say, you know, call a salesman, and if you go through the 2-hour tour of the remember they used to do that.
Yeah, that doesn't work anymore.
Doesn't work anymore. Now you got to make it easy, easy, easy. You have to be the person that gives them 24/7 off the website the information they're looking for. So an email will work, but once again, it better be a relevant message to that particular title, that particular person, that particular industry, of something that is on their mind right now that's keeping them up at night, and they will thank you for it. So you got to use the web, and this is where the biggest mistake, I might add, the biggest mistake is to think that, you know, you're going to ask all these questions of people and they're going to tell you the truth,
right,
and their buying intentions. It never did happen. And so I'm always, you know, let it go. You know, the information, you know, put it out there. Let them download anything they want to see, and then the right people will come back to you, and they will then want to talk to a salesman. But I don't want to hard qualify them. I don't want to ask the question about their buying intentions until I've earned the right to ask the question.
All right, so you have to build the trust.
Build, and that's a real key point, trust. And I think really you need to become the trusted advisor, because they don't need product information. They can go to the web and they get overloaded with that. You have to be the person that's going to help them distill all this information, all these competitive advantages and features, to how it's going to work for their organization. So you have to prove your competence first. Okay, and if you prove your confidence by the information that you're sending to them, you have to, there's another company in town that pushes what's called pushing the free line. You've got to give away a lot of free, so that when they're ready to buy, they say, you know, you're the person that has helped me the most in this buying cycle, and I think you'll help me the most after this buying cycle, and therefore I give you my business.
So do you find that some companies are like, well, we don't want to give this all away? I mean, they're afraid of giving away their good stuff.
Well, I'm not sure you can give away too much. You really can't. It's kind of like if you go in the malls, for example. You know, you go by those fast food places, you're handing out the samples.
Right.
It does the number on me a lot of times. You know, do a U-turn and buy something I wasn't going to buy. But, no, I think, you know, like in our case, we're real generous with free trials because the product proves itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd rather have someone try it for a while and know it works. And we have our, we offer software as a service, so there's really no capital up front, and it can cancel very easily. And so it's kind of like, if you're not going to get a benefit out of this, I don't want you as a customer. And it's real easy for us to set them up. So it all works real well, win-win. But in today's world, you buyers are very leery, and you know, you've got to give away a lot and make it up over time and recognize a lifetime value of a customer. The first order might even be a loss, but then you get to create a lifetime relationship and you get the referrals, which are the most valuable.
Richard, talking to you is like hooking up to a fire hose of marketing wisdom. I wish we had all day, but maybe we can have you back sometime.
Well, thank you. That'd be fun.
How can our listeners get in touch with you if they would like a little bit more of that Richard Brock wisdom?
All right. Well, they can email me at rbrock@leadlife.com. That's LEADLIFE.com. rbrock@leadlife.com. Or 678-672-3125.
What a terrific and informative interview, but you know I'm not going to let you go just yet. Every interview that we do here at the High Velocity Radio Show, we ask our guests to share with us a mistake they've made somewhere in their career and what they've learned for it. Would you do that for us?
Well, it's a mistake that worked. It goes back quite a few years ago when I had a software package selling to CPA firms. And by way of background, I was a CPA, so I would send direct mail to CPA firms, and I would advertise in a magazine. My number one competitor was not a CPA, and so he never sent direct mail. All he did was advertise in the magazines. I was mad because I always got the better positions. But what he did is he went to trade shows, and I never saw the value of going to a trade show. So we were number one and number two. We were number one, by the way. But at any rate.
just want to make that clear.
Yeah, but he sold his business for a lot more money, so he ended up better. But at any rate, he was a very good competitor, and we did a lot of things together socially, believe it or not. We would go to dinner all the time, things like that. But it bothered me, and I should have realized, I had a lot of quiet deals. And a quiet deal is where we weren't competing with him, and we should have been. Well, similarly, he had a lot of quiet deals. So the mistake is that I was not thinking out of the box. I wasn't being adaptive. I wasn't looking about where my competitors were advertising, so I should do the same. So I would say that the barometer is if you're getting quiet deals where there's no competitor involved and you have some good competitors, that's great. And don't tell them what you're doing. But assume they're doing the same thing. So you really need to watch what your competitors are doing well and be in the game with them so that they at least have to compete for the business. And you can basically – that was my mistake, was kind of just dealing with the familiar as looking at what is the possible. So the familiar always screws up the possible, if you will.
Oh, what an important lesson. Well, until next week, this is Stone Payton, Lee Cantor, Steve Winokur, Richard Brock, Don Rigby, and all the team at Radio X – wishing you a terrific week, and we'll see you in the fast lane.